Hey, everybody, and welcome to The Brand Called You. So listen, I was thinking a couple of years ago about an incident that happened. My brother and I decided to take my mother out for Mother's Day. It was my idea to take her to the Pierre Hotel, the fanciest hotel in New York, for high tea, because my mother is Hungarian and she likes sparkling fancy things. And my brother, who's a PhD in physics and a mathematician, thought it was ridiculous. But I convinced him. So suddenly the waitress comes over with the pot of tea, and it's this stunning sterling silver pot, just exquisite. And my mother goes, "It's wonderful." And I say, "It's beautiful." And my brother says, "That's so ridiculous the way it conducts heat, so unnecessary." So I said, "Michael, can't you just enjoy it?" And he said, "No, I can't." And I realized that not only has this been a problem in my own family, this disconnect in dialogue, but it's really a problem that's going on in companies throughout the world, right? You get R&D who can't talk to marketing, you get sales who can't talk to procurement. There are different types of people in this world who speak different languages. And that's why I'm so excited to have our guests on today, Holly Blum and Beth Elkiss, who are creatives working in the pharma industry, an industry they have figured out a way to bridge that magic divide between the language of data and your heart. And I want to hear how they do it. So welcome, ladies. It's just a pleasure to have you both. I thought I would start by introducing a little bit to our viewers about who you are, and then we'll go from there. So let's start with Beth. Beth Elkiss is the executive creative director of life science at Accenture. And she's a 20-year veteran of the pharmaceutical and advertising industry. She's headed up creative teams across so many diverse areas, such as oncology, urology, ophthalmology, to just name a few. And I'm particularly interested in an initiative that she's involved in now, which helps, it really helps the unmet needs in women's health, and they're offering solutions. So I can't wait to hear about that. Holly Blum has her MFA in fine arts painting. She's an incredible painter, but she spent over 30 years applying her artistic skills to pharmaceutical advertising in some of the industry's largest agencies, including Bezzell, FCB, and Ogilvy Health. And she helped to launch numerous products for conditions associated with, as I mentioned, erectile dysfunction, surgical pain relief, diabetes, and so on and so on. So both of you ladies have had decades of experience doing what you do. So I'm super, super fascinated having, as I said, grown up in a family of geeks and nerds. We could never talk to each other. And I also watched my father, a brilliant cancer research scientist, not get the grants he wanted because he couldn't tell the story of his cancer research. And I watched my brother not be able to get his PhD positions because he simply couldn't tell the story of why he was a good candidate for a teaching position. And I think in many ways, the two of you really do the same kind of work. So maybe I'll just start with you, Beth, which is you obviously were trained in the creative fields, the artistic fields. Why would you pick something as, to me, dull and frightening and monotonous and mundane as science and pharma to weave your magic with?
Well, lovely to be here. Absolutely thrilled. And you know, it's a little bit of a mystery to me too. I started out in consumer advertising, business to business, with majoring in graphic designs, communications, and marketing, and was doing work for companies like JVC and MetLife. And I live in New Jersey, and New Jersey happens to be the hub of pharmaceutical companies. And little did I know, pharmaceutical advertising agencies. So right in my backyard are all of these large ad agencies that are really cranking out a lot of the campaigns you're seeing in the pharma world. And it kind of happened by chance. At the time, I was working in consumer, and I was president of the Art Directors Club of New Jersey, and I was a bit of a networker, and I decided I wanted to look for another job, so I kind of got the word out. And somebody said, "Hey, give this guy Jim a call." I didn't know Jim. Turns out Jim worked for a large pharmaceutical ad agency. I figured, let me go see what that's all about. And I'd like to think it was the best decision I have ever made. I love a challenge, and I love doing something unique. I had the fortune of working alongside Holly, and we still do to quite a bit on many brands. And you know, doing breakthrough work and interesting work in areas like prostate cancer, in areas like HIV, things that you wouldn't think you could be creative in. So to me, that's a big challenge. And when we do it, and I'd like to think that we've had some breakthrough success, it makes it all the much, you know, more sweeter.
So maybe you can guys just explain to our viewers, what does a creative do? What does a creative director do? What are the roles involved in being a creative in a company that's, for example, science driven? Can maybe we'll start with you, Holly.
So the creative director, it depends, I guess, if an art director or creative director, but on a creative director level, you're involved in the very beginning of brand positioning and brand creation. So we're you're coming up with you're involved in the marketing plan, where you're taking the marketing plan and you're involved in coming up with a personality for the brand, a key messaging platform, but more heavily down the road, what that brand will look like, how will it sound? And then all from that, all of the pieces that the marketing team would need to eventually sell that brand. So that's conventions and public, you know, advertising and other things.
So, but like Beth, you would be in it from the first meeting with the brand?
So it really depends. In some cases, we actually have a hand at naming the brand. So it might just be the generic that's come out. This is before launch, and they need a name, and they need, you know, a color palette. And then once we have the name, we do branding, we develop the name, we develop, like I said, the color palette, the look and feel, the tonality, we create branding guidelines so that all the agencies and all the partners that can touch that brand will utilize these guides so they have a unified voice. And then from there, you know, we look at the competitor, let's say it's a brand that's new to market, but there's a lot of competitors. So we look across the competition and we make sure that our messaging and our look and feel is distinctive and different and really showcases our advantage. But what you were saying earlier, you know, it is a challenge. And that is, like I said, what I love about it is because everything we do has to really be approved by the FDA. So every message, every claim, even visuals, you know, if they see, like Holly and I worked on a campaign that, and I mean, it's out there so we can talk about it, which was for prostate cancer, which showed a doctor's hand pushing back on this beast. And the beast was made out of the tumor environment. And it was like kind of your worst nightmare. And that represented the prostate cancer going, you know, metastasizing, right? Raising its head. And so it was like the doctor was keeping the prostate cancer at bay so it wouldn't metastasize. That was kind of the whole thing. And the FDA said, even if you don't have a word on the page, that visual is showing that that drug can take control of that tumor environment and keep it back. And so even if you have just the visual, nothing else, you must have all of your fair balance and small, you know, all that small copy we're used to. So, yeah.
By the way, for our international viewers, FDA is the Federal Drug Administration, which everything has to run by. But, you know, so as a story strategist, which I am, I'll get called in to, I remember somebody wanted to help me with his gene therapy pitch. I personally always start by saying, how does it affect me personally? What do I feel emotionally about this? And then I kind of start to craft a story, but it always has to be fueled by something that moves me personally emotionally. And what I found with my clients is that the mistake they made is they always say, what are the most important facts we need to deliver to our audience? Rather than saying, what moves me, fascinates me, gets my emotional regions of my brain acting up. Is it the same for you guys? Do you start with an emotion? Let's say, Holly, you said you worked on erectile dysfunction. You're being given a series of data.
Yeah. And I think it's the industry's changed a lot. Early on, I think we had, there was a lot more time in really deep dive into the product, into the people who use the product and how they feel about their condition, how they feel about the treatments out there. There was just more time and money put to, you know, educating the creative team. So I think what happens is, and at that point,
sorry to interrupt you, but when you say educating the creative team, you mean teaching them the science?
Well, educating in, as in you've got a brand, you know nothing about it sometimes when you walk into the room and you are tasked to making it come alive. So you need to do, you know, you'll have the medical officer will come and talk to you about how the drug works in the body. People will, you know, nurses, practitioners will tell you how the patients feel. Maybe, you know, you'll get some background information, basically. So it's like a down, it's a download.
Right.
And I feel like over time, it's that has gotten smaller and smaller, the download, and you get less and less. But during that time, when I was working on that erectile dysfunction, we would do these big patient journeys of, you know, every moment in, you know, from the diagnosis of something to the doctor's office, you know, what are they feeling? What are their concerns and their worries? So yeah, it wasn't emotional. It felt like you could really get to something that had a more emotional reach in your end product, which would be what your messaging would be and your storytelling and your visuals. And
so that was your would you work off of that journey to come up with a concept?
Sometimes it helps inform and so you understand better what, you know, someone might be feeling. And so, sometimes it would, it definitely would influence. But the concept has to come up, has to ladder up to the key one sentence, idea, that central idea in the creative brief that they want to. And that was issues too. I think that was the biggest issue was when, sometimes they have very generic creative briefs, you know, like efficacy without compromise. Yeah, which, okay.
Means nothing, basically.
It means nothing. Or they have, you know, a better life, but you couldn't talk about, or a longer life, but you couldn't talk about longer life because it only gave you 1 month more than the competition, you know, for like a cancer patient. And you can't make a claim. So nothing was actionable against that creative brief. So that was a big challenge.
You know, it's so similar. The work I do is so similar. I mean, I wasn't creating pictures, but I was creating words that made pictures. But the one thing I found was there was the use of language that was inane and meaningless was overwhelming. And I don't know if you found that too to be the case, Beth, that you have to kind of transcend all the words to get to the core story.
Yeah. So I worked with somebody, a partner, a copywriting partner for 13 years. I still work with her now, even though she retired, but she'll work with me, Holly. And we used to call her Queen Weasel because to be a really strong pharmaceutical conceptual writer, you have to know how to weasel it. You have to know all the tricks on how to get your message across, but do it in a way that the FDA will not flag it. And, you know, the best, you know, like Holly was saying, we work from a brief, and the best briefs are the ones that do have that ladders up to that emotional benefit and gives you that nugget, that authentic truth that then you can transcend, right, into breakthrough communication. So, and even you were talking about the journey before, really, you know, there might be a moment that matters. There might be a moment in that journey that's a barrier or that's an opportunity. And that's where, you know, I'd say the best work is we can get in there and understand that and then bring that to life. But a good pharmaceutical writer, it's a real skill set. It really is. You know, you're navigating a lot of landmines, and to get something decent through is kind of a heroic a heroic thing to do. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard that a good story isn't what happens to you. It's how you resolved a conflict and then were transformed as a result. And I'm guessing that you guys are kind of constantly illuminating transformation somehow.
But exactly. Yeah.
What fascinates me is how you do it like visually, like talk about color, for example, like, do you have long, you know, I don't know anything about your world. So I'm just picturing, do you have to like have long fights with a CEO about what color represents what, or, I mean, how does this work?
It's science-based also. So yeah,
really?
So, regionally, there are emotional response data to certain colors. You know, green can give you the feeling of freedom, of health. You know, they communicate certain things. So there, if you approach it scientifically, you can back up your argument and you could sell the color. So there's two things. One is, what is all your competition using? Let's say you had to come up with a logo for a new brand and you've got 5 different competitors in the marketplace. What color space on the color wheel do they populate? And so then you see the free area, and then it's storytelling too. Okay, there's a red, there's a yellow, orange, and there's a purple. Which one of these, from an emotional response lens, gives you the best brand color? So, you know, is it a health thing? You know, whatever. So you can back it up and present it in a pretty strong way. The word in order to justify and bring someone along to speak, like you said before, the same language, because you can, yeah, you can define each step.
But you bring an interesting point to my mind, which is cultural differences. I mean, you worked with global brands. Do you have to change the colors and the messaging according to country? Because like I worked in the Netherlands for many years. And I remember if I even said something to my client, like, that was great, just the word great, wouldn't be met with such suspicion because of it's a country fueled by Calvinism. And so using expletives was met with total suspicion in that culture. And I'm just wondering if you had sort of similar cultural variations that you had to contend with and how you dealt with that.
Yeah, I mean, you do a search by country. If you landed on, let's say, a yellow, you want to make sure that yellow isn't a marker that's used at funerals or for death. You know, we think here it's happy and sunny, but actually yellow in larger fields can be irritating. So there's a lot of science behind it. But yeah, we would look to across where the brand is going to be released. And, you know, do those colors resonate on a cultural level in that area as well? Is it going to say the same thing on an emotional level?
I mean, did you ever have a disaster culturally where you offended one region?
Thank goodness I did not.
No. How about you, Ben?
No.
I haven't, but we also do a lot of market research. So, you know, it's not like we just design it, put it out there and hope for the best.
Yeah.
If we do know we're going to, let's say, 6 markets, we'll do testing in 6 markets.
Right,
and we'll
right.
catch, you know, we'll catch it in market research if there's anything that we've missed, so we can, you know, address it before the brand is out there.
Yeah. All right. So now I want to get to the gender thing, because both of you are women. Was this traditionally a male-dominated area, or was the art and design and imaging always kind of more female driven?
I don't know if I don't usually think of things that way. So I didn't, I don't know, Beth.
I would say it's interesting because I've gone through different stages. I think in our industry, leadership has been, you know, very much white men, right? But creative, is a mix. On some teams, we're all women, right? And I see that a lot now. And although years ago when I worked on women's health brands, and we're talking, you know, I worked head of J&J's women's health and urology franchise for an agency. My team on women's health back in the day were all men. So it was interesting. It was very interesting. Now,
I mean, interesting, but
yeah.
How did it change the nature of your work or define it for you?
Well, these guys used to say they would go to a party and they could talk birth control with the best of them. I mean, they really got in touch with their feminine side. They were immersed in estrogen every day. So I think they embraced it. But what's a little different now, a shift, is, like you mentioned, I've had 13 years where I was really immersed in that therapeutic area.
So when you say unmet needs, you mean of people within a specific field, or do you mean the general public, or what?
I mean, women take up 51% of the population.
Right.
And for an example, menopause. 100% of women, if they live long enough, are going to go through menopause. But menopause until recently right. Now, Oprah's all of a sudden, but until about a year and a half ago, menopause was like a rare disease. Nobody talked about it. God right. forbid you're in the workplace and you talk about it. In fact, 10% of women in their prime, hitting their stride, would leave the workforce due to menopause symptoms. This is a statistic wow. that we know. I know. Yeah. So finally, things are happening and moving, still not enough. But look, the Super Bowl ad, you know, hot flashes, not flashes. You would have never seen that 5 years ago, ever. It just wouldn't have been, it would have been a taboo subject. It would have, nobody was talking about it. And when you ask women even, have you talked to your mother about their menopause experience? Most women would say no. Again, it was just not something we talk about. And now finally it's coming to light. But that's just an example of, we're finally getting started. But there's so much, you know, so much more we can do to support women. Femtech, feminine technology, very underfunded. I think, I don't know the statistics offhand, but, the dollars are, you know, billions of dollars of potential there. But because it's for women, investors don't want to put their money into it. They'd rather put it into something, you know, a more med tech. So these are things that we're looking at.
And when you say looking at on our terms, is it an initiative that would go into?
So it's we call it like an offering, and mm-hmm. Accenture, we pair with our clients and we look at different industries. It could mm-hmm. be the beauty industry getting into health, for example, and we're starting to have these conversations. So this is just kind of getting off the ground, but it's something, as I think you can hear, I'm very passionate about. Again, there's just as the majority of the population, you know, I think it was until 1985, no women were included in clinical trials. I mean, that's not yeah. that long ago.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I just interviewed a woman who has a new kind of, it's not really impact investing. It's people who want to donate their money to unmet needs of women's health. And so they're using donated money as a way of funding this fund. But I hear this a lot in different forms, but it also makes me wonder whether you guys, having been in this industry for 30 years or so, had to kind of somehow squelch, or at least in its early days, kowtow to sort of more male authority figures, or change your behavior a bit to accommodate. Like, I mean, how did you, as women, change over time in terms of your assertiveness, your confidence, I don't know, other things like that?
I did have a funny story. I was working for a menopause drug and for vaginal atrophy. And we showed a number of concepts, and one had a woman in jeans, you know, with a belt. And I flat out was told that menopausal women don't wear jeans. It's too young. And here I was, menopausal woman, sitting in front of
jeans.
Them, wearing jeans.
So what
at the time I just didn't, I looked over at my account person who was like shaking his head, like, don't say anything. And I didn't say anything. And I think, yeah, it's time to just say, no, I might beg to differ, you know, kind of thing. Yeah. But I felt that, you know, yeah, there was a kind of a, I think it was maybe more of a client agency relationship too, you know,
yeah,
where yeah. you know, you don't want to argue in there, but yeah, it felt a little funny. And the entire team was men. I had a little different experience, I guess, from Beth, was male on that product. And it was hard getting some ideas through. It was just very difficult.
Have you had the same experience, Beth? I mean, now I know you're obviously leading the teams, but I was just curious. And
It's an interesting question. I think I was really fortunate because I always worked under very strong women, like account leads, who were tough. You know, they were tough broads, and I think they just kind of like pushed the door down, and so it made it easier for me. It really did, because if there was a fight to be had, they weren't afraid. And you know, a few in particular were just very strong, accomplished account leads and very strategic. And they just knew, kind of like, you know, the old E.F. Hutton, like when they talk, like the clients listen. So I was very fortunate to work, you know, on teams like that, because then we were able to push the best work through and we didn't have to limit ourselves.
What is the Inspiration Council that you're involved in? That was very interesting to me.
Oh, so that was something that Holly and I worked on when we were at Ogilvy Health. We wanted to create a culture of curiosity. And Holly, as you might know, is extremely curious and appreciative of art in creativity in every form, whether it's cooking, you know, or painting and everything in between. And I'd like to think, not the cooking part, but I am a very curious, I like to curate, you know, I like to go to galleries and I travel and I put things in the back of my mind for use to kind of put forward, you know, when we're creating, might be a convention, you know, for oncology. And I'll be like, oh, you know, I remember seeing something and then bringing it back. And we just thought, you know what, let's bring that to our teams. And so we called it, this is Ogilvy Health, Oh, wow, right? And because when you are inspired, you're like, that's the reaction you make, like, oh, wow. And we just, we had outings. We had people from the agency come in. One did printmaking, kind of showing their you know, side hustles. We had another guy who was really a very much of an avant-garde dresser. Like his wardrobe was cutting edge, and he came and he had a fashion show. He took people in the office and restyled them. And we literally had like a photo shoot. And we brought all these things in to kind of reinvigorate or invigorate the team to start thinking differently. And it was really a highlight, fantastic. I think, of our time there. Yeah,
totally. You know, I was thinking about one of my first clients ever was a woman who did not believe in vaccination. This was long before COVID, like 10 years before. And she wanted help with a presentation she was making. And I really had to wrap my head around how I could help her when I didn't agree with her science. And the only way I could do it was by making it her personal journey and her personal story. And I wonder if you guys have to sometimes take on products or campaigns that you don't agree with or don't believe in, and if you have strategies for doing that. Is that too vague a question? Is there anything that comes to mind over the years?
I think just maybe like when I get a brief that I just don't understand, I have to sort of go around it and make up my own story. I can't think of specifics, but I go in and find that emotional tug, and and it's going to be from me and my perspective, but it's the only way in to creating something that I feel strongly about and that I feel will touch other people. But
have you ever been offended by a product, or, you know, philosophically in disagreement with it, and you still had to
remove myself
really?
Yeah, I said that I can't give 110% to a product. So it's unfair for them to hire me for that product because I'm not behind it. So I refuse myself. So, but I had done a little search on it and found that there was a grassroots sort of complaint about it, that it caused cardiovascular. It was a diet drug. That only gave you a difference of 5 pounds per year versus diet and exercise alone, you'd get 5 pounds more loss. And then 5 years or 10 years later, I found out it had been recalled and pulled off because of that problem. But I had a problem.
So you removed yourself though.
Yeah, I said I can't sell this.
What about you, Beth?
Nothing that comes to mind, although I did launch kind of a blockbuster brand that later, you know, they found delivered too much, you know, of an ingredient that they realized and they did pull it. So that was tough. Hindsight, but the data didn't show it at the time. The studies were not designed for that at the time. But I think I've been fortunate. I've been, you know, working on either drugs that really can make a difference for people that really show an advantage. I mean, one thing that I do love about the industry, I know people are like, you know, the big pharma, but I always say, you know, to my friends and people, if you live long enough, they're going to come out with something. And you know, I have friends who or people I know, coworkers who were diagnosed with something that just at that moment, right?
Yep.
Either a drug was approved or it was a clinical trial, some in like stage 4 cancers. And you're like, you know, doesn't look good. And just at that minute, they got on it, whether, like I said, clinical trial or recent approval. And it's years later and they're climbing mountains and they're living their life to the fullest. So there's also something really exciting. I'm going to just kind of look at it from the other side, is getting in on the ground floor and seeing, you know, technology or science or medicine that's being done in the for the first time that's a game changer and can be part of that. So that's one of the biggest reasons that I do love my job.
I was going to ask you about that. Who was involved in the Youngest Donor campaign? Which one of you was?
Okay, was so I was. So that was a passion, a 10-year passion project. So many years ago, I had a friend whose husband suffered from AML and they couldn't find a living donor for bone marrow transplant. And they said, oh, he got a donor. It was from umbilical cord blood. And it was a boy baby and a girl baby. And they said, Lucy and Desi. And they named these cords Lucy and Desi. And this is, oh my God, now let's say 15 years ago. And he's still like in remission to be good. And I said, and I had just had a baby at the time. And I had paid to bank the umbilical cord because you don't know. But, you know, a lot of people didn't, you know, the odds of you using it are very slim and it's not cheap. And I said, nobody talked to me about donating. Like donating never even got on the radar. And so
you mean
this
donating was, your umbilical cord?
Donating. You have a baby and you donate, like you would donate blood. Here's the umbilical cord because it has these rich stem cells that can cure up to 80 diseases.
Wow.
And they're thrown away as medical waste every day. Every day. You are throwing something that could save a life into the garbage. And I was really like shocked by that because I just had a baby. Nobody talked about donating. Look, because it's not, you know, the companies where you bank it, it's a money-making operation. But if you donate, you know, it's an altruistic thing to do, but nobody's really making money on that. And I said to myself, it was always in the back of my mind for about 10 years, I want to raise awareness here. Nobody knows about this. So I was given the opportunity when I was at Ogilvy to actually bring it to life, and they invested, and we found the Parents Guide to Cord Blood, which is the number one global recognized nonprofit.
Yeah.
And we created a video and we got to put this on a lot of birth plans.
Wow.
Because also, since this is global, what people don't realize is chances are if you donate it, it'll be there for your baby if you need it, because the odds of Matt having a perfect match is very slim. So again, I still feel like there's so much work to be done, but it was a passion project that I was really excited to see, you know, come to fruition.
Did you art direct it as well, the project?
So I led the creative team. I worked on the strategy, and this was in conjunction with, I identified this, oh my God, now her name escapes me, Frances Vetter, the head of this globe. And I worked with a creative team to drive this program. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're using your skills every day to do stuff that really makes a difference. It's beautiful. I can't believe that we've already been talking for like 45 minutes. I've kept you way over what I promised, but I really can't thank you enough for taking a little bit of time to share with everybody what it is you do. Who are the Reds and the Blues and the incredible stories behind these laboriously data-driven products. And now I know it's amazing women like you. So thank you so much for taking a little bit of time.
Thanks really for having appreciate us. It.
Yeah, and I wish you all the best in all your other projects.
Thank you so much.
Thank you guys so much. Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.